Welcome back to Mark's Madness, now part of Chunkaluta.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, we're doing it again.
It's actually all three of us, except at any point, my newborn will wake up and I will have to feed her while talking, if at all.
Well, we'll have to feed somebody to the worms at some point.
Well, I'm gonna jump into the shark pit.
Yeah.
Laser shark pit. It's an Austin Powers scene.
Yeah, that's right. Just get a gun and shoot him. Anyway.
Just get a gun and shoot him. It's like when somebody hears about the Barbaro pit.
Anyway, welcome back.
If anything, that was a better idea than shooting.
Yeah. We're back. Mark's Madness, part of Chunkaluta. We're going to be resuming on slide 197 of the Gramsci Reader that Prez has put together for us, which is the foresight and perspective section within the Modern Prince. Before we jump back into the Modern Prince, obviously there's a whole hell of a lot going on in the world.
How cool would it be if he talks about a bridge collapsing in this
country? Oh my God. Let's take it the Simpsons.
Let's talk about some foresight and perspective on, say, a collapse of a bridge.
Yeah.
But you were here for last week where I got roasted for like three paragraphs.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was not here. I did hear it in edit. It was quite amusing, but it was like a personal attack.
I'm like, I'm just glad to quit.
I'm glad I wasn't here for it because there was some stuff I needed to introspective on from that too.
Yeah, I was like, shit, you're right.
I ducked it so hard.
The benefit of doing this all in advance is that I get to lord this over you guys, but I had to do this all before this. So I get to
to be fair, I read up to around here probably a little bit before.
Nice. But, nice.
Yeah.
So you were like, you know what? I know enough right now. I don't have to worry about what he's going to say. The embarrassing statement part.
That makes it more poetic. That's
I know. It's really a testament to half-assing. I was like, Prez did all the work on this season. I don't have to.
Yeah, I skimmed it. Oh, I missed the part I needed, but I skimmed it.
I skimmed up to it, which is worse. Like I could have at least continued skimming.
He's talking about how oil determines things. Oh, shit.
Shit. Yeah. Shit. Yeah. The immediate next sentence.
Speaking of things with, you know, economic factors in their cause, but are not economically deterministic, we are back in current events in a world where, obviously, there's the ongoing genocide against Palestine. And to my understanding, they're moving in on attacking Rafah, and they have basically fully, attacked and pulled people out of and arrested people in Al-Shaiva Hospital. Not that any hospitals have any damn power anymore to actually, help patients, and they haven't been bombed shitless all over Gaza. But yeah, things are progressing poorly there. Obviously, you have displaced people across Sudan and the Congo. So we'll just cut that mistake. And then, of course, in Baltimore, this was early in the morning, so there wasn't a lot of traffic on the bridge. And I think traffic was slowed down additionally because of construction. You can see some semi-trucks that just made it across. But there was a ship that had just left the port there in Baltimore, turned around. It was a huge ship to be going under that bridge. I don't know about, the intelligence, the design of this. There was a similar boat into bridge collapse in, I believe, the 80s, the Sunshine Bridge in Florida. So this is not something that people haven't seen before and couldn't have learned from. But I believe that the story now is that the boat had a power failure, which caused it to kind of drift, and then the current drifted it directly into the pillar of the bridge. But there was 8 construction workers on there, or 9 construction workers on there, and like one or two had gotten to safety. Apparently, these construction workers from this company that was contracted are largely immigrant labor from South and Central America, which just shows and there's a big racist pitchfork hunt, manhunt for the idea that one of them, like, apparently was rescued and did not want to go to the hospital and stuff. Never mind medical bills and the risk of deportation in this country. And that should start a conversation about the dangers of the way we treat immigrants and our for-profit.
That's like an ambulance ride. Right?
Yeah.
Like $800.
Yeah. And instead the conversation gets hijacked by racists of, you know, how this is some nefarious conspiracy or some shit like that. And
it's like, give me a $10 cab. What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. I think I even saw there was something on social media going around where someone accused an elected mayor of being, I don't even know what DEI means.
Oh, diversity, equity, and inclusion hire.
God. Yeah. See,
yeah, no, so it's Jack Posobiec.
Majority black.
Well, this is Jack Posobiec and Alex Jones. And it's very weird.
Yeah.
That like mutuals of mine are
mayor.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, no. Baltimore is 60% black.
Yeah.
It's like, if anything, having a white person would be the
DEI.
Have you guys seen that Always Sunny in Philadelphia episode where they're trying to essentially have some stupid-ass thing happen in the bar? And this is after Mac comes out as gay, finally. So he's like, well, actually, as a gay man, I have better say than you over this. And then they look up at the demographics of Philadelphia after losing, and Charlie and Dennis are like, well, actually, straight white men are statistically the minority in Philadelphia. So really, we should have a greater say than you, Mac and D.
That's materialism, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
At socials who would do that though.
But really, this whole issue is like, if you see a side shot of this boat, boats should not be this big.
No.
That was my first thing.
Not in a port where bridges exist.
At least not a bridge that doesn't go up, you know?
Like I get, like, you want a bridge that goes across a bay and you want a port in a bay. I get those two things. Like, you can't have boats this big going under a bridge.
Well, see, I'm used to the Mackinac Bridge when I think of bridges, and that's a little...
Yeah, we're... The fact that the U.S. has horrible crumbling infrastructure aside, if you put a boat that size into a bridge, no amount of... like dolphins or whatever many pieces of infrastructure in front of it to like bounce it off is going to stop it.
No,
that boat is going to break something.
Well, the point of the dolphin is to redirect it. Right. Which is like,
but
a step in the right direction. But even then it's like,
that boat is too big. The boat is too much, like the length of the thing.
Well, right. It's the high, like if it went at a lower part, it would have hit just from height. You know, like it's super tall, super wide. It's like Jeff Bezos building his yacht in Amsterdam town, was it? I can't remember.
Rotterdam.
Well, Rotterdam.
And then when he pulled out, they got mad that they took the bridge down.
Yeah. At least do that for this size of a fucking ship. Money-grubbing
Dutch people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like, you know, like, at least that's for like fucking shipping stuff. Over there, they took apart that bridge for some rich dude's yacht. You know, it's like fucking. Maybe they had an excuse for something really important needing to be shipped on one ship, but just seems like greed.
Yeah, no, and yachts are fucking massive. And if you wanted to make like the next biggest step towards ending climate change with one move behind ending the U.S. military, the next biggest one would be just get rid of all yachts. Like, they're fucking massive gas guzzling, just shitmobiles. Anyway, with that, I think we're ready to get into the reading. And I was not here last time, so I will read. Foresight and Perspective. This is on slide 197 within the Modern Prince. Another point to be decided and developed is that of the double perspective in political action and state life. There are various levels in which the double perspective can be presented, from the most elementary to the most complex, but they can be reduced theoretically to two fundamental levels. Corresponding to the double nature of the Machiavellian centaur, savage and human, force and consent, authority and hegemony, violence and civilization, the individual stage and the universal stage, church and state in parentheses, agitation and propaganda, tactics and strategy, etc. Some people have reduced the theory of the double perspective to something paltry and banal, that is, to nothing but two forms of immediacy which follow each other mechanically in time with greater or less proximity. But it can happen that the more the first perspective is very immediate, very elementary, and the more distant must be the second, not in time, but as a dialectical relationship. The more complex, elevated. In other words, it may happen, as in human life, that the more an individual is constrained to defend his own immediate physical existence, the more he sustains and sees himself from the point of view of all the complex and most elevated values of civilization and humanity. It is certain that to foresee means only to see well the present and the past as a movement. To see well, i.e. to identify with exactness the fundamental and permanent elements of the process. But it is absurd to think of a purely objective foresight. The person who has foresight in reality has a program that he wants to see triumph. Foresight is precisely an element of this triumph. This only means that foresight must always be either arbitrary and gratuitous or purely tendentious. Moreover, one can say that only to the extent to which the objective aspect of foresight is connected with a program does this aspect acquire objectivity, because only passion sharpens the intellect and cooperates in making intuition clearer, because since reality is the result of the application of the human will to the society of things, of the worker to the machine, to put aside every voluntary element and calculate only the intervention of other wills as an objective element in the general game is to mutilate reality itself. Only those who strongly want to do it identify the necessary elements for the realization of their will. I love when Gramsci goes after objectivity and the snooty falseness of it. Therefore, to hold that one particular conception of the world and of life has in and of itself a superior capacity of foresight is a mistake of the crudest fatuity and superficiality. Certainly, a conception of the world is implicit in all foresight, and therefore, whether this is a disconnected series of arbitrary acts of thought or a rigorous and coherent vision is not without importance, but it acquires importance precisely in the living brain of the person who makes the prophecy and brings it to life with his own strong will. We see this from the prophecies made by so-called dispassionate people. They abound in indolence, minute subtleties, conjectural elegances. The existence of a program to be realized by the foreseer is enough for him to reach the essentials. Those elements which, being organizable, susceptible to be directed or redirected, are in reality alone foreseeable. This conflicts with the common way of considering the problem. It is generally thought of that every act of foresight presupposes the determination of regular laws, of the same type of laws of the natural sciences. But just as these laws do not exist in the absolute or mechanical sense, which is supposed, so also this view takes no account of the other wills, and their application is not foreseen. Because of this, constructions are made on an arbitrary hypothesis and not in reality. This is an interesting read that I'm still trying.
Is this like a cult of personality critique, I feel?
I wonder. I mean, there's jabs at objectivity. There's jabs at the idea of a universal foresight and the purpose of a foresight and that foresight reaching that goal.
There's a concept that people use later that he uses occasionally, but not so much. The idea of scientism, which is you know, objectivism or objectivity, but it's more so just the dedication to science and more so technocracy. And this bureaucratic idea that as long as we have, you know, a study that proves whatever we're doing, then we can go ahead with it.
Or as long as we means tested enough.
Exactly. Or as long as there's a correct cost-benefit analysis. Cost-benefit analysis is like the distillation of scientism, because it tries to operationalize exactly life itself. There's a cost and a benefit to everything that exists, and we can quantify it. There's a quantifiable, there's a quantifiable level of being able to get out of bed in the morning or stand up.
Yeah. Too much and therefore superficial mechanical political realism often leads to the assertion that the man of state must work only within the sphere of effective reality, not interest himself in what should be, but only in what is. This would mean that the man of state must also have no perspectives longer than his own nose. This error has led to Paulo Treves to see in, God damn these names, Guicciardini and not in Machiavelli, the true politician. Okay, now we're just throwing out names to show off. Graham, she's back to it. Anyway, it is
necessary. That's an accurate description of what just happened.
Yeah. I don't know who Guicciardini is, but it sounds very Italian. Anyway, it is necessary to distinguish between the scientist of politics and the active politician, as well as between the diplomat and the politician. The diplomat can only move within effective reality, since his specific activity is not that of looking for new equilibriums, but of conserving an existing equilibrium within a certain judicial framework. Thus, also, the scientist must move inside an effective reality insofar as he is merely a scientist. By the way, obviously, Gramsci is not limiting to comparisons like this, but just an example of what he's talking about here, assuming I understand it correctly, is the people that are like, but who's going to stop the murders if we don't have cops? Right. People who, you know, can only live in a certain constructed realism of what's around them. But Machiavelli is not merely a scientist. He is a partisan and with mighty passions, an active politician who wants to create new relations of forces. And because of this, cannot help concerning himself with what should be, though certainly not in the moralistic sense. The question is not, therefore, to put in these terms, it is more complex. The point is, in other words, to see whether what should be is an arbitrary or necessary act. Concrete will or a hopeless wish, a desire, a yearning for the stars. The active politician is a creator, an awakener, but he neither creates from nothing nor moves in turbid void of his own desires and dreams. There is a beautiful sentence to lay out historical materialism there.
The issue is then people like Haas devoid this of their entire fucking, the rest of everything, and then go, I'm a partisan just trying to change politics.
Yeah, that's true. Any of this you could distill down and strip up the necessary context and make it say anything. Just fucking shit. He bases himself on effective reality, but what is this effective reality? It is something static and immobile. Or is it not rather a relationship of forces in continuous movement and a change of equilibrium? To apply the will to creation of a new balance of the really existing and operating forces, basing oneself on that particular force which one considers progressive, giving it the means to triumph, is still to move within the sphere of effective reality, but in order to dominate and overcome it or contribute to it. What should be is therefore concrete and is moreover only realistic and historicist interpretation of reality. It is the only act of history and philosophy, the only politics. The Savonarola Machiavelli opposition is not an opposition between what is and what should be. The whole of Rousseau's paragraph to this point is simply word show. God damn Gramsci. But between two should-bes, the abstract and cloudy one of Savonarola and the realistic one of Machiavelli, realistic even if it did not become immediate reality, since one cannot expect one individual or one book to change reality, but only to interpret it and indicate the possible lines of action. Jesus Christ, underline that one. Machiavelli's limits and narrowness consists only of his having been a private person, a writer, and not the head of state or an army, who is still a single person, but who has at his disposal the forces of the state or an army, and not only armies of words. One cannot therefore say Machiavelli was also an unarmed prophet. This would be to belittle the spirit. Machiavelli never says that he is thinking of changing or that he has set himself to change reality, but only that he is showing concretely how the historical forces ought to have worked in order to be effective. So a lot to reflect on in there.
Oh, I fucking... You know, I like that it's a warning, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people will stop and only read this part, you know? I think that's how we got Haas. But I guess maybe by the end of this, I'll be like, MAGA communism was right. I think Prez wouldn't do that to us, though.
No, I don't think so.
Well, you stopped at a random point last time, and then you got absolutely bodied by the next paragraph. So you just got to keep going. Just
right, yeah. That's why I'm reading. Like,
yeah, yeah. Keep reading. But I do want to run this back, and I made a joke about constructivism, assuming I have that definition correct, where it's like, you know, this is a social construct, political construct type stuff.
I thought it was a guy who does construction work.
No, I'm pretty sure it's like when people say that's a social construct, like that's under construction, which I mean, shit is, right? You know, I was having a conversation with someone the other day about anti-realism mathematics, which is not necessarily constructivist, but has constructivist undertones. Yeah, I mean, the idea that, you know, reality is going to be biased, right? There's not this objective. It's going to be constantly moving. And Machiavelli wasn't trying to, you know, hide a bias or change the world. He was just trying to write about like how this shit should work. And you know, you should understand his impact as that.
Analysis of situations, relations of forces. The study of how situations need to be analyzed, i.e. of how the different levels of the relation of forces need to be established, can lend itself to an elementary exposition of the science and art of politics, in the sense of the totality of practical canons for research and of particular observations useful for awakening interest in effective reality and encouraging more rigorous and vigorous political institutions. At the same time, an exposition should be made of what must be understood by strategy and tactics, by strategic plan, by propaganda and agitation, by the science of organization and administration and politics. The empirical observations which are usually expounded here and there in works on political science, parentheses, as for example in G. Mosca's book, The Elements of Political Science, and parentheses, ought insofar as they are not abstract matters or with no solid foundation to find a place in the different levels of the relations of forces, beginning with the relations of international forces and going on to the objective social relations, i.e. to the level of development of the productive forces to the relations of political and party forces, hegemonic systems inside the states, and to the immediate or potentially military political relations. Do international relations precede or follow logically the fundamental social relations Undoubtedly, they follow. Every organic innovation in the structure modifies organically the absolute and relative relations in the international field through its technico-military expressions. Even the geographical position of the national state does not proceed but follows logically the structural innovations, though reacting on them to a certain extent, parentheses, to the extent precisely to which superstructures react on the structure, politics on economics, etc., end parentheses. On the other hand, international relations react passively and actively on the political relations of hegemony of parties. The more the immediate economic life of a nation is subordinated to international relations, the more a certain party will represent the situation, exploit it in order to prevent any advantage for the opposing parties. Remember Nietzsche's famous speech about the technically impossible Italian Revolution. From this series of facts, the conclusion can be reached that the so-called Foreigners Party is not the same as it is popularly called, but it is in fact the most nationalistic party, which in reality, rather than representing the vital forces of its own country, represents its subordination and economic slavery to the hegemonic nations or groups of nations. Does that make sense to people?
Makes sense to me.
I was going to say, this is talking about like colonized nations and how, I can't think of the word subordinate to the imperial powers, you know, leaders rise to the top. Is that not what I'm saying here? Yeah. Comprador. Thank you.
Yeah. He's talking about the Compradors.
Yeah. Compradors are going to naturally rise to the top in that situation. Cause that's what power is going to allow. Okay, cool. We're on the same page then.
It is the problem of the relations between structure and superstructures, which needs to be posed exactly and resolved in order to reach a correct analysis of the forces working in the history of a certain period and determine their relationship. One must keep within the bounds of two principles. One, that no society sets itself tasks for whose solution the necessary and sufficient conditions do not already exist, or are not at least in process of emergence and development. Two, that no society dissolves and can be replaced unless it has first developed all the forms of life implicit in its relations. And then there's a footnote. Quote, no social order ever perishes before all the productive forces for which there is room in it have developed, and new higher relations of production never appear before the material conditions for their existence have matured in the womb of the old society. Therefore, mankind always sets itself only such tasks as it can solve, since looking at the matter more closely, it will always be found in the task itself only when the material conditions for its solution already exist or are at least in the process of formation. Marx, preface to the Critique of Political Economy.
This
fucking asshole.
Not only Marx off the dome, but this is once again, basically, you know, spent a bunch of time tearing down economism, which I think people spur out of over-reliance to historical materialism, right? Or over-emphasis of it. And now he's sitting there like, you know, underscoring the point of historical materialism and the reality of it. It's just brilliant. Like, rip away all the fuck ups and bring back the base idea that was right. Thank you.
Yeah, why aren't we using it as a methodology? Why are we using it as a science?
Right.
It's a fact.
Like, yeah.
I don't know.
And sometimes when you're organizing, you'll encounter someone who's so busy dreaming about the future, they're not worrying about how we're going to get to step one.
Yeah.
From reflection on these two canons, one can successfully develop a whole series of other principles of historical methodology. However, in studying a structure, it is necessary to distinguish organic movements, relatively permanent from movements which could be called incidental, which appear as occasional, immediate, or almost accidental. Incidental phenomena are certainly dependent as well on the organic movements, but their significance has no great historical importance. They give rise to a petty, day-to-day political criticism, which concerns the small ruling groups and the personalities directly responsible for power. The organic phenomena give rise to historico-social criticism, which concerns the large groupings, those beyond the immediately responsible people and beyond the leading personnel. In studying a historical period, this distinction appears of the greatest importance. A crisis appears, which sometimes lasts for decades. This exceptional duration means that incurable contradictions have appeared, have come to maturity in the structure, and that the political forces working positively for the preservation and defense of the same structure are exerting themselves nevertheless to heal them within certain limits and overcome them. These insistent and persistent efforts, since no social form is ever willing to confess that it has been superseded, form the basis of the quote-unquote occasional, on which was organized the antagonistic forces which aim to show a demonstration which in the last analysis only succeeds and is true if it becomes a new reality. In the antagonistic forces triumph, if the antagonistic forces triumph, whereas in the short term there develops a whole series of ideological, religious, philosophical, political, legal polemics, etc., polemics whose concreteness is to be valued by the extent to which they succeed in conquering and displaying the existing array of social forces. That the necessary and sufficient conditions already exist, which make possible imperative the historical solution of certain tasks, imperative because every shortcoming in historical duty increases the necessary disorder and prepares more serious catastrophes. This section is really, really important because this is essentially where we haven't gotten to it, but we're going to see him talk later on about Caesarism and more about his theory of crisis, where he goes into the whole idea of crisis of authority and what happens when you have essentially a Bonapartist clash or a Caesarist clash, where you have a crisis where one ruling group can't be overtaken by the other and you essentially have a stalemate. And that's what he meant by a crisis appears that can last for decades. They can last forever. We're seeing this happen in the U.S. right now, where we just have a long ongoing crisis. But this concept pretty much is the basis for his theory of fascism, how fascism develops. But also, that whole bastardized quote, "Now is the time of monsters," that we see pop up every once in a while, is not actually him. That was fucking Zizek who did that. The old world is dying, a new world struggles to be born, now is the time of monsters. The real translation is, now is the time of a great many morbid symptoms. And this is him talking about that when you have a decades-long crisis, you have a lot of shit going on. And that quote is somewhere else, but this is also an explanation or an expansion on that concept, that these things can happen for a very, very long period of time and cause a lot of different things to be going on, ideologically, politically, economically, that are contradictory, but not enough to cause like the revolutionary moment. And he talks later about how you need to seize these contradictory things. Anyway, the error often committed in historical-political analyses consists in having been unable to find the correct relationship between what is organic and what is occasional. Thus, one succeeds either in expounding as directly operative, which instead operates indirectly, or in asserting that direct causes are the only effective causes. In the one case, there is an excess of quote-unquote economism or pedantic doctrinarism. In the other, an excess of ideologism. In the one case, an overestimation of mechanical causes. In the other, an exaltation of the voluntarist and individual element. The distinction between organic movements and events and incidental or occasional movements and events must be applied to all type of situations, not only those where one sees a reactionary development or an acute crisis, but to those where one sees a progressive or prosperous development, and to those where one sees a stagnation of the productive forces. The dialectical nexus between the two kinds of movement, and therefore of research, is difficult to establish. And if the error is serious in historiography, it is still more serious in the art of politics, where we are dealing not with reconstructing past history, but with building present and future history. And then there's a footnote. Failure to consider the immediate stage of the relation of forces is linked with hangovers of the popular liberal conception, of which syndicalism is a manifestation, believing that it is more advanced, while in reality it took a step backwards. In fact, the popular liberal conception giving importance to the relation of political forces organized in the various forms of party, newspaper readers, parliamentary and local elections, mass organizations of parties and trade unions in the narrow sense, was more advanced than syndicalism, which gave primordial importance to the fundamental economico-social relations and only to these. The popular liberal conception implicitly took account of these relations, also, as appears from many signs, but insisted more on the relations of political forces, which were the expression of the former and in reality contained them. These hangovers of the popular liberal conception can be traced back to a whole series of writings which purport to be connected with Marxism and have given rise to infantile forms of optimism and folly. One's own, and then we're back to the main text, one's own inferior and immediate desires and passions are the cause of error, insofar as they are substituted for objective and impartial analysis. This happens not as a conscious means to stimulate action, but as self-deceit. Here also, the snake bites the charlatan, or rather the demagogue is the first victim of his demagogy.
So thank you everyone for listening. Sorry for the short episode. We're going to write this down where we're ending. and because it's a weird spot, try to remember it. Read on without us, really, you know. We got things going on. The Patreon is really important to support so we can field professional organizers and help grow popular support among the masses instead of just online BS. You know, $5 goes a long way. A lot of people are losing their jobs, and that's worrying. but also, you know, even more reason to feel this work quicker. And then we'll be launching GoFundMe, hopefully on April 1st, by the time this is out. And, it, you know, you'll hear about everything going on that end of things and what we're raising money for. So, yeah, those are the plugs. There's also ways to complain, which is marksmadness@gmail.com, chunkalutanetwork@gmail.com. Or, you know, we have X accounts, or which is at marksmadnesspod, and then at chunkaluta.org. Or, you know, my personal account at decolonialmarks. My daughter's making noises. I love it. But, you know, any disagreements or things you wanted us to think about, you know, that we should have talked about this episode, you know, direct them that way. I don't know. Did I miss anything?
No.
No, I think you're it. So, again, don't be afraid to go to linktr.ee/chunkaluta network for all the links. This has been Mark's Madness Pod, part of Chunkaluta Network. We read books. My name's David.
I'm Prez.
I'm Shumani, too.
And we will talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.